morning to you. You are listening to The Third Degree on 2SER 107.3. My name's Simon Unwin. And today on the show, we're going to be having a special focus on international agreements on the environment and climate change. One of those, the Montreal Protocol, has been in place for 25 years. It's been pretty successful. You might remember that little issue that the protocol was drawn up to deal with, the hole in the ozone layer. Are there lessons there for the Kyoto Protocol? We'll also discuss another agreement which, well, it doesn't exist yet. We'll turn to that one first. What kind of protection exists in international law for those people likely to be displaced by the effects of climate change? Well, it turns out less than you might expect. David Hodgkinson is an Associate Professor of Law at the University of Western Australia, and he's leading a project that aims to draw up an international convention for persons displaced by climate change. He joins me now. David, what are the effects of climate change that are likely to cause population movements? I mean, sea level rise is the big obvious one, but are there others?
There are, and there are a number of reports now that essentially warn that the effects of climate change, and those effects include rising sea levels, more frequent and severe storms, and heavier floods, as well as drought and desertification, will cause large-scale population movements.
Okay, so what kind of provisions currently exist in international law for people who are displaced by climate change? Is there anything?
Not in terms of conventions or in terms of treaty. There is, of course, the Refugee Convention, but of course that won't take account of climate change displaced persons because, of course, they don't fit in terms of the definition of a refugee, and so that struck us immediately. And it does seem to us, to our project team, that a treaty for climate change displaced people will not only assist those likely to be displaced, but will also fill a gap in terms of current protections with regard to those likely to be displaced.
Okay. So what would a convention or treaty look like? What would it do?
In outline, it would provide a general framework for assistance to those likely to be displaced by climate change. And as I just said, it would address gaps in terms of current human rights, refugee and humanitarian law protections for climate change displaced persons. It should be noted that most people made homeless by climate change or in danger of climate change displacement are expected to stay within their home countries, within their own borders. There's much focus on Pacific Island states, for example, and those likely to be displaced. But it's very clear that the vast majority of those who are likely to be displaced will be displaced within their home country. So we're really talking about the provision of adaptation assistance more than anything else, simply to allow people to stay in their homes for as long as possible. Mm. Or to be able to move in an orderly fashion over time. So at its heart, it really is about the provision of financial and other assistance so that people can adapt to the effects of climate change. The poorest countries in the world are those likely to experience the most severe impacts of global warming. And so the treaty would provide for contributions to a fund for climate change displacement by developed state parties.
Okay, so there would be that kind of climate justice element to the convention that you're proposing?
Yes, I think that the most difficult issue will be the provision of adaptation funding. And in terms of the provision of those funds, even though as a starting point we would use the principle which underlies the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and its Kyoto Protocol, that is the principle known as common but differentiated responsibilities. Essentially, the developed states have caused this problem and they should bear the burden of addressing it. But ultimately, I think in terms of the provision of those funds, it would simply come down, to negotiation. You know, there are obviously causation issues here in terms of the extent to which climate change contributes, to a particular weather event or population movement. So we would adopt a very likely standard in that regard.
Okay, and whereby in order for a displaced population to be considered displaced by climate change, then it would have to be a displacement that's very likely to have been caused by
human-induced climate change.
Sure.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, and I think really, and I don't want to take you through a whole range of definitions, but I think there are two relatively short but precise definitions that I think are important. And one is the definition of a displaced person, and the other is the definition of a climate change event. So for us, climate change displaced persons or people would be groups of people whose habitual homes have or will become temporarily or permanently uninhabitable as a consequence of a climate change event. And we define a climate change event as sudden or gradual environmental disruption that is very likely caused by anthropogenic or human-induced climate change. I'm sorry for all of those.
No. Look, I mean, this is by necessity a sort of quite a legalistic conversation to be having because
Yes, and you know, and we are at the end of the day proposing a multilateral treaty, not within the UN framework. It should be said, given the length of time that process would take, but a treaty nonetheless. And of course, as a result, there will be, you know, it's a legal instrument, and so will at times be quite legalistic.
I mean, I find it interesting that, you know, you've identified those gaps in the current, you know, convention on refugees and so on. And I suppose in terms of today's political language, there is a lot of potential for people displaced by climate change to be dismissed as, say, you know, I think the phrase is economic refugees. Rather than genuine refugees, they're just people who, you know, they're not quite happy with their situation economically. Or
I agree, and I think that's to some extent unfortunate for our particular treaty because we're really, the treaty really is not focused, and in fact climate change displacement is not, the focus of climate change displacement really shouldn't be a focus on refugees or migrants because the percentage of people likely to cross an international border, I think I said at the outset, is relatively small. This is essentially a treaty about providing adaptation assistance to allow people to stay in their homes for as long as possible. And in the event that, and Pacific Island states perhaps is the best example of this, that where it's clear that either entire states will become uninhabitable, again, small Pacific Island states, or that people will cross borders, then in that case, under the treaty, states won't be obliged to accept those displaced, climate change displaced persons. The treaty would provide a framework for assistance, but it would be made very clear under the treaty that states would only be obliged to accept people if they, under the framework of the treaty, actually entered into bilateral displacement agreements with the particular country. So again, no obligation under the treaty for states to actually accept those that have been displaced by climate change in another country.
Interesting.
I think if we weren't to do that, I think if it were to be a provision by which state parties would be obliged to accept those that had crossed an international border, then I think it probably would be dead in the water from the beginning.
I was going to say it might not be very popular.
Nor viable.
But I suppose the convention ideally would provide a framework for perhaps negotiating those bilateral agreements?
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, I think in the way that I've just described it, we maximise our chances of success.
Sure. I suppose to play devil's advocate for a second, that I assume that there are people who would argue that current provisions in international law that we have are, you know, more than enough to provide for the negotiation of those kinds of bilateral agreements. And, you know, surely this is something that can be sort of sorted out if and when these major displacements happen.
Yeah.
What would you say to that?
I think the answer is there is no provision in international law which deals with this problem. And in fact, even you know, some say that, well, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change is an appropriate forum within which to address these issues. But again, that particular instrument and certainly its Kyoto Protocol aren't designed to deal with the displacement problem. We see this particular treaty as forming part of a range of climate-related agreements which deal with specific aspects of the climate change problem, what others have called a kind of climate change regime complex. that given the lack of success in terms of adaptation funding under the UNFCCC and the difficulties in terms of mitigation under Kyoto, that maybe one way to address the climate change problem is to break it up into little pieces and address the issue in specialised fora and through specialised agreements. And in that case, it may be that dealing with climate change displacement through a dedicated treaty, you know, and if it works and if it does get the requisite number of signatories, then it could actually point the way, you know, to dealing with the climate change problem more generally, perhaps more effectively.
When you're talking about adaptation and you know, adaptation versus mitigation, and I know that in the academy around climate change, these two concepts are fairly well understood, but I suppose for our listeners who might not immediately recognise, you know, adaptation as, you know, in the context of climate change, and when you're talking about adaptation funding and helping people to remain in their homes, I mean, yeah, what does that concept of adaptation mean for these people?
I guess for our purposes, there are two main concepts, and they both find voice in the current climate change regime. So mitigation, that is mitigating the effects of climate change. So emissions reduction targets, for example, are an example of climate change mitigation. And adaptation means adapting to the effects of climate change. And so with mitigation, adaptation becomes easier. And I think in the popular literature, there's a real focus on mitigation targets. And so, for example, we have the Doha climate talks coming up in December. And the focus there, at least in terms of press coverage, is on mitigation targets. You know, in a second Kyoto commitment period, will developed states sign up to new targets? What will they be? Should developing states have targets and so on? But I think as the climate change problem worsens, rather than a focus on mitigation and with its attendant difficulties, there may well be a much greater focus on adaptation, that is, adapting to the effects of climate change as the world gets warmer. And so for us, this project is a form of adaptation and could form one piece of the adaptation problem, that is, and the adaptation solution, that is, adapting to the effects of climate change, ensuring that people through adaptation assistance can remain in their homes for as long as possible, or moving in a planned manner over time.
Yeah, I suppose
adaptation is a little easier, I think, to understand than mitigation, because when you start to talk about emissions reduction targets for developed state parties to the Kyoto Protocol, then it does start to get pretty technical. But I think adaptation is something that most people can understand because the problems are very real. What do you do, to put it in stark terms, when your habitual home, you know, a home in which generations have lived, is in danger because of the effects of climate change, or indeed at the extreme end, when your island may well disappear? Those particular issues are, the science may be difficult, but the effects are increasingly visible. And so we hope that in terms of our treaty, because it essentially proposes to deal with climate change adaptation, and adaptation is at its heart, then at least that threshold issue is crossed, and perhaps the difficulties are not so much in terms of understanding the issues, but just the political will to actually, you know, ratify the treaty.
And that's, I guess, what I find really fascinating about those adaptation discussions is that, I mean, you know, for example, we've spoken to people on the show from Kiribati, you know, small Pacific Island nation, very much under threat from climate change. I sort of get the sense from them that they feel relatively sure that they'll be physically safe, you know, that the people, they will find places to resettle and so on. But what is really traumatic in terms of these displacements is what you talked about, the fact that generations have lived in, you know, these same areas and they have traditions and cultures. And that's, in a lot of ways, what's most under threat from these effects of climate change. I mean, does your proposed convention, would it speak to those kinds of issues?
Yes, and I think in terms of threatened island nations, for want of a better term, rising sea levels and the prospect of those nations becoming uninhabitable are amongst the most visible consequences of climate change. And, of course, those populations may not only be displaced, but they may also see, you know, the effective disappearance of their homelands, so that even though they may amount only to a fraction of the total number of likely climate change displaced persons. You know, the interests and expectations of the populations of those nations have very high profile in the international system because of the possibility of effective loss of homelands, which differentiates those from other regions in which there is likely to be large-scale displacement. And so in our proposed treaty, we set out three principles with regard to Pacific threatened island nations in terms of relocation, and that is the principles of proximity, self-determination, and the safeguarding of intangible culture as applicable to those regional bilateral agreements which I spoke of earlier between threatened island nations and, you know, a host state, for example. And those bilateral agreements, as we discussed earlier, would be negotiated under the framework of the convention.
That's a really interesting phrase, you know, the preservation of intangible culture. And I suppose that, you know, those issues of the preservation of intangible culture would persist even in situations where you're talking about displacement and internal migrations, you know, within a particular state, because obviously you have regional cultures.
Absolutely.
And hopefully the framework would be able to be used in those situations as well.
Yeah, precisely. You know, and ultimately, as I say, our aim is to enable people, you know, to make the choice themselves whether to remain in their homes for as long as possible or to seek out, you know, new, more stable, you know, communities elsewhere, whether that be within that state or in another country pursuant to or under an agreement which had been negotiated between their home state and the host state. You know, these are difficult things, even though internationally displaced people will form a small group of those likely to be displaced, and Pacific Islanders even a smaller group. In terms of that smaller group, you know, you're looking at people's lives changing in ways which perhaps they haven't for centuries. And we're just concerned, given our focus on adaptation, you know, provide for those both displaced internally and across borders in the most effective way possible and with the support of the international community.
And in a way that's just, I guess.
And in a way that's absolutely just, in a way that protects families, which allows families to stay together, and simply to preserve, you know, threatened livelihoods. It really is simply about the provision of adaptation assistance and the provision of or strengthening of current homes or planning for future homes, either within a state or across borders. You know, treaty making is hard. I think everyone knows that. But my hope, our hope, is that when governments understand that it is about the provision of adaptation funding, and, you know, under the UNFCCC framework, states have already agreed to provide each year $100 billion in adaptation funding from 2020 onwards. It may be that this treaty framework may provide itself a framework under which that kind of money can be distributed and can assist those very likely to be displaced by the effects of climate change.
Yeah. Now, look, I find it really fascinating that, as with so many elements of climate change discussions and I suppose treaty making more generally, that it's often a continuation of those post-colonial discussions and legacies of the colonization of the global south by the north and how that plays out in so many different spheres.
And that's a great point, because not only I think are we and many others, you know, planning for a climate change future, but of course we're also dealing with, in many respects, with the past, as you suggest, and it's, you know, the clash of those two things which additionally make the problem difficult.
That's Professor David Hodgkinson in discussion with me about the project to write an international convention on persons displaced by climate change. To read more about the project, you can head to ccpdconvention.com. You are on The Third Degree. I'm Simon Unwin, and we'll turn now to an agreement that's been around for a while now. In fact, it turned 25 this year, just like me. The Montreal Protocol on Substances that Deplete the Ozone Layer has been remarkably effective in coordinating the world's efforts to reduce emissions of CFCs. Professor Ian Ray is an organic chemist and an honorary fellow of the University of Melbourne. He's been part of some of the UN committees working within the Montreal Protocol framework, and he joins us now to talk us through how it works, why it's been a relative success, and what we might learn from its experience.
It took a while before the science was properly understood and accepted, and then it took a while before countries agreed that it was possible to do something about it without ruining their economies. And in this case, it's a smaller spread of change that's needed than in the case of climate. So it's always interesting to compare the two protocols. Montreal Protocol, it was possible, and industry indicated, yes, it would be possible to produce new substances that didn't have the ozone-depleting potential, but would still do the job, and at a reasonable cost. So all these things are important when you're striking an international agreement. The other key thing about the protocol was that quite early in the piece, not at the beginning, but quite early, the developed countries agreed to put money into a fund to help the developing countries to meet their obligations. So a really poor country wanting to sign up, but saying, God, if we signed up, we could never afford to do all these things, can now feel assured that at least there's a chance they can go along, make a case, and get some money to fix up their act. And that's been terribly important in the Montreal Protocol. It doesn't exist in other international conventions, but developing countries will always like to have one.
Looking at, I suppose, how the protocol was negotiated in the first place, I think we've seen with some of the really large meetings about climate change, the most memorable disastrous one being Copenhagen.
The Copenhagen, mate, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, those are really massive affairs and huge plenaries and that sort of thing. Was the Montreal Protocol negotiated in a sort of different way?
No, it was a similar way, but there wasn't quite the same heat about it at the time. But environment groups mounted the case at most of the meetings, and they still do. I go to a meeting, I'm going to one in November, a meeting of the parties, and there'll be a number of environment groups, and they'd all get a chance to speak at the meeting and urge their views on the delegates.
In the early days of the negotiation of this protocol, 25 years ago, I suppose there would have been a similar level of, if not scientific uncertainty, then certain quarters being a bit unconvinced about the depth of the effect that we were having on the atmosphere.
That's right.
As
and
a
how
species.
Far it would spread and all that sort of stuff. That's right. It didn't have the same really nasty edge that we're seeing with climate change. But yes, those oppositions were there, doubting that this was a phenomenon that was going to persist for very long. But there had by then been almost 20 years of data collection, so there was enough to indicate that there was a problem and it was getting worse.
I suppose the treaty would have to take into account a certain amount of change in the scientific consensus.
Yes, it did.
So how's it done that?
It's done it by accelerating phase-outs. In the first case, the CFCs, which were the most significant global warmers and the largest users in refrigeration, on spray cans got a bit of a mention, but the real use was in refrigeration and cooling and things like that. The protocol set a phase-out date for developed countries, which was much sooner than for developing countries. It was about a 10-year difference. And that meant that the big users and big producers could get on the way with getting rid of it. They could afford it. And the others were given a bit more time to meet their deadlines. But once they got that out of the way, they started to look around and say, well, the replacements that we've been using are still ozone depleting. They're only about one-tenth as bad, but they are ozone depleters. And so we ought to set some timelines for getting rid of them. And so those timelines were set about 5 years ago, and they're now starting to come into effect. In 2015, we'll see the first step down. So instead of just saying, look, in 2015, it's banned, the article says, look, in 2015, you've got to come down by 10 or 15%, I've forgotten the exact number. And then there's a series of steps. You can visualize this little graph in your mind going out to about 2030 for developing countries, but sooner than that for developed countries. And that sort of thing takes account of the science. It says, well, we're doing the right thing, but we're not doing enough. So we better start moving on those things.
And so those decisions have been made relatively recently. It's not just...
That's right. Yes, there are fine tunings going on all the time. And because the protocol works by consensus, if somebody's out of line, there are sort of punishment clauses in the convention, but they're never exercised because the approach has been to say, okay, your country's out of compliance. You're using too much or you're emitting too much or something like that. What are you going to do about it? What help do you need? What can we do to get you back into compliance? And so that's been very successful. But from time to time, there are countries that are out of compliance, and instead of being punished with trade sanctions and all the sorts of things like that, they're actually given assistance to meet their obligations. And that's been very powerful.
Yeah. It's, I don't know, I suppose, as you were saying before, it is interesting to compare the experience of this of this treaty and, the fine-tuning and the negotiation and all of this, all of the details of this mechanism, and to compare it to, the real struggles that the international community has had in actually coming to a consensus about how to reduce climate change emissions.
That's right.
It's a much
bigger problem. We're seeing it now. If you're able to stand back a little from it, the ozone problem looks smaller and manageable than the climate one. And it's still a pretty big problem. It's loomed for 25 years. But compared to climate, it doesn't look so bad. And it is in hand.
What do you think are the biggest lessons to take away from the experience of the Montreal Protocol so far, and how do you think those can be applied to, other international agreements on complex chemical and economic sort of matters?
There need to be a number of things. There needs to be acceptance of the science, that the science says, look, here's a problem, and we think you better start doing something about it. It doesn't always tell you how to solve it, it just tells you there's a problem. Like, we've already got that with climate. And then there needs to be innovative ways of dealing with that problem. And that happened with the Montreal Protocol. People found ways to make refrigerating gases and fire suppression and foaming agents for making polyurethane foam and all the other uses of the CFCs. They found ways to do that without getting ozone depletion. And that's one of the sticking points for the climate thing. Nobody's found a way to make cheap electricity in the way you can do it with a coal-fired power station. So you get people who say, look, we've really got to stop using coal, even if it costs us a lot more money. And that wasn't the case in the Montreal Protocol. It didn't cost a lot more money to adopt the new chemicals. It cost a little bit more. They were new, but not much. So they're the two key things. And then, of course, the existence of the multinational fund that enabled countries to have hope that they will be able to meet their obligations if they sign up in a way that... You hear it talked about in the Kyoto Protocol discussions too. We need money to meet our obligations, and that hasn't happened.
I guess I get a bit curious when you talk about an acceptance of the science, because we know that with a lot of the climate change science, while there's scientific consensus, there's a drastic lack of political consensus. And in fact, a lot of the companies that could possibly be researching their way out of this mess are actually throwing lots of money at PR and really fighting... fighting the idea of mitigation of climate change.
Yeah, there are some that are starting to move and more and more getting on board and realising that something is going to happen and it's going to threaten their business, and they better start doing something about it. That's the major driver.
Mm. And I suppose it's interesting to see that in the case of CFCs, these major companies have really been brought on board in terms of engineering around the problem rather than advertising.
Politicking. Yep, that's quite right. Yep, they've been able to do it. But nobody's been able to do it and replace coal-fired power stations. That's the crux of the climate action. I mean, there are still people doubting science, I know, but if it was easy to do and cheap to do, we'd have done it by now, we being the rest of the developed world. Mm. It's not. That's the big problem.
It's Professor Ian Ray speaking to me there about the Montreal Protocol. We're totally out of time on the Third Degree. My name's Simon Unwin. See you next week. Thank you.